Welcome, welcome, welcome to Son of a Pitch, the podcast where we dive deep into the art of transformation and personal growth. I'm your host, Michael, and today's episode promises to be an exhilarating journey of insights and revelations featuring a very special guest, Kevin Rahman. Join me and Kevin as we explore the delicate dance between motivation and change, delving into the profound wisdom he shares. We'll unravel the secrets of shifting our perspectives and embracing the unknown, all while uncovering the power of anxiety as a driving force. In this episode, we'll delve into the importance of routines and rhythms in reprogramming our behaviors, discovering how small changes can lead to profound transformations. Kevin will reveal his unique approach to harnessing intrinsic motivation and hacking our patterns to drive lasting change. But it doesn't stop there. We'll also discuss the role of external events in shaping our journeys, whether it's a traumatic experience or a significant life event that propels us forward. Together, we'll challenge the notion of complete control over our lives and explore the profound impact of uncertainty and embracing the abyss. So buckle up, my friends, because Son of a Pitch is here to ignite your curiosity and propel you towards the extraordinary. Get ready for a captivating conversation that will leave you questioning everything and redefining what's possible. Stay tuned as Kevin Rahman takes us on a thought-provoking expedition, sharing his invaluable insights on transformation, self-discovery, and the fascinating journey of personal growth. So, today's a fun day, because today we are chatting and talking and exploring all the deliciousness that makes you, you.
Nice.
Right? So, for those uninitiated, for those people living under a rock, for those people that have never met you, Kevin, who the fuck are you?
I think I'm a simple guy that tries to change things, explore, and mainly to understand people and the world a little bit better. Because I think that's something that I've always been looking for. People are weird, man. And
amen.
I try to understand people a little bit better. Well, actually, I always found myself to be perhaps even the weirdest, but perhaps everyone feels that way. But I have potentially found a reason why I felt that. And okay, the solution is Ritalin.
The solution is who?
Ritalin. It's a...
Ritalin makes you weird.
No, it makes me sane. It makes me calm. So I've been doing an experiment with Ritalin, and it makes me completely zen. And normally I seem to never be able to stop the thinking in my head.
Okay.
So I'm doing an experiment with it right now, because the other strategies that I used to adopt, they don't really work anymore.
Your doctors are aware you're experimenting with Ritalin, right? Like, is this, or you're just like meeting some guy in the corner and they're like, yo, man, I got some Ritalin for you.
No, I told my doctor, actually, that could happen. So we're doing this with or without you. So okay, he was like, okay, then let's do it with me. But there's an experimental design and everything. So if I go, then I go full Monty.
You go full in. Okay.
Full Monty, because there's only one way to live life, and that's full Monty. Because time is precious.
Sounds like you know a little bit about that.
Yeah. They're like, a couple of years ago, there was almost no more time for me. I think I was like... Well, it was like a carpenter working on the casket already, because I was yay close of having zero time anymore. That changes your perspective on things. It also is quite annoying, because you don't do bullshit anymore after that.
Because well, what happened?
I've had a, I think it's called a TBI in English. It's a traumatic brain injury. Yeah, it was a crazy couple of years after that. But what actually happened was really weird. I was like sitting in the kitchen with my wife and she was talking to me and I thought I was talking back, but it was mostly gibberish that came out.
Wow.
And I got headaches, extreme headaches a couple of days before already. But yeah, then you just get painkillers and think, okay, let's move on.
Yeah.
Life happens, headaches happen, work, stuff, kids, or at least one kid by then. It just move along. But when I started talking gibberish, then she got kind of scared. So she called my parents and like tried to get me to come into the ambulance, but I refused.
Why is that? Because,
coping. You do either fight, flight, or freeze. I was freezing.
Shit.
Like, okay, my brain is trying to comprehend what happened.
Yeah.
And I can't. So what do you do now? And I froze. I was like, okay, no, wait, I need to wrap my head around this. Something is happening and I have no clue what. So I ended up in the hospital in a bunch of neurological tests and they concluded that I had a encephalitis, which is a brain inflammation.
Wow. Roughly you catch that from anything or?
I have no clue. They don't know. The disease is known for about 10 years and they have no clue what it is. We have no clue how to research the brain. And that's so they can do a brain, a back function, a spine function. Is that?
I think then whatever the opposite of an epidural is, I guess.
Yeah, it's, I think, yeah, it's an epidural and they then go between the...
I am not a doctor, by the way.
They go between the discs and they get brain fluid from your back that comes from your head.
Yeah.
So that's a bit the only thing that they can measure. And then they just pump you full with drugs. And I was like in a sort of mental coma for a couple week, 2 weeks, something like that.
Holy shit. I'd be scared shitless, man.
I have no clue what happens. My family was scared shitless. And I have no idea what happened because I was gone. You could talk to me, but I wouldn't respond. I had no idea what happened.
Wow, dude. And how long ago was that?
4 years ago, something like that.
Wow. So talk to me a little bit about the between then and now, what happened? What's been going on?
So after a couple of weeks,
because like I'm listening to you, you don't sound like you're talking gibberish now.
Oh, I was scared when I got home that I would end up being able to do nothing. Because when I got home, I could I slept for 20 hours a day. I couldn't talk. Right, could talk a bit, but you would ask me a question, and then I would be like. It's like your computer freezes. You know, when you see the ball on your MacBook, it's like, and then after a couple of minutes, I would provide a simple answer. Well, Zoom meetings take quite a long time if you have that. So that was not possible. So for a month, I sulked in self-pity and just, I think it was necessary to just cope with what happened a bit. But after a month of laying in bed, doing actually nothing, I was like, okay, there's no one that's going to help me get out of this but me.
That's
so
fair.
I have to at least get going. So I designed my own way back. So I just, I used my work expertise as a Scrum Master, Agile Coach to... adapt in complex situations. So I was like, okay, I need knowledge. So I read a bunch of papers on the disease that was difficult to read, but I managed to get through to get a little bit more insight. And I started to research how do you recover from TBI. And I ended up making like a daily
routine or something, or
daily routine based per quarter what I needed to do, from eating to exercising. I researched a whole bunch of vitamins, ginseng root is, there's research that ginseng root has like a couple of percent good influence on the recovering of neuron paths in your brain. So I was like, "Dad, I'm going to take this." I ended up doing research for athletes, where they measured the stress in your brain and your body, and how much do you need to stress yourself to get better. The gist is, 100%, they're not getting better. 120%, you're actually getting worse, because then you're over stretching yourself. Like, you need to be somewhere at 110%. So if you have like a stretch yourself, if you stretch it too far, it snaps. If you don't stretch it at all, it's like flubble. You don't want that. You don't want flubble.
No, you don't want flubble.
You don't want snap, but you want on a little bit on edge.
Okay.
And so I've been doing like iterations in a day and in a week. Okay, how is my stretching going? And that was difficult, because sometimes you don't know what 100 is. You don't know what 120% is. You adapt.
Yeah. How do you determine your limits? How do you know when you're about to snap?
Yeah. Well,
what
by
are your
snapping
signals.
In the beginning, the feedback is fast. So if you like go on your PlayStation, the controller, it.
Yeah, it vibrates.
You get the feedback quite quick. So
yeah, exactly.
You end up like the fog in your head gets intense. You get tired. And okay, there's the upper limit. But you get better over time. So it's like a moving target. So you need to create data. Do it daily. So have the daily set routine, so you can see variance in that data set. Okay, I can handle it better. Okay, I can go like, can I go 5 minutes longer in exercise? Let's try it. Okay, oof, damn. And ultimately, you'll snap a couple of times, which ended up me being in bed again for days on end or weeks on end.
Yeah.
Crumbling out of the depth again and just trying again. And I did
that. So what other kinds of things did you discover in your journey to recovery that helps make the way our minds work sharper, or helps improve the way we process information? What kind of things did you pick up that you think that people could learn from this injury and use, injured or not?
Well, multiple things, I think. Well, we are resilient. We can do way more than we believe. And I discovered that because I needed to. But the resilience that I experienced was so deep and so much, like it hurt, but the hurt doesn't matter. Because if you want it, you can. So that's for me, like I feel that real deep within myself. I want it and I can make it happen. Even though it's complex and I won't get exactly what I want, but I'll get there quite far if you desire to. And do the work, really do the work. Because what made me improve was repetition. Creating, and I used like tiny habits, and there's a lot of theory on how you make your own behavioral patterns. I used that to do the stuff that I tried to achieve within myself. So you can design your own life if you work on the different external influences that are around you. Those two things can help you enormously in changing, getting something, trying something, experiencing something. I think
so. What were some of the top external influences that you had to focus on to tweak?
Well, the patterns that you're used to.
Yeah.
So you break them. It's like how you eat, what you eat, but also what you drink, how you drink. Do you drink alcohol? Do you use drugs? Stuff like that. That those are all influences. Who do you meet? Do you spend time with family or do you spend time studying?
Right.
Do you, how do you balance your life? And I'm still working on that. It's still out of balance. That's why I'm doing the experiment that we just talked about. It makes you at least appreciate time and challenge, okay, what do I need to do right now with the time that I have, which is quite limited? I think that's the most thing that I'm still thinking and working on.
Do you think that's the biggest driver for you, the awareness of the finitude of life?
Yeah. And to me, it's now like it's two ways. I don't care anymore. This is my second life. I can do whatever the fuck I want. And I'm going to do whatever the fuck I please. And it's liberating. It's the autonomy that I experience is like, okay, I don't care what you think. I'm going to speak my truth and whatever you want to do with it, it's fine. I don't even have the, I don't need to change you. Just be you. This is me. Take it, leave it. I don't care. Because I know what's true.
Now, some might say that's ignorant of the world around you. It's just like you are very you-centric. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I am saying that in my experience, the moment you start saying, I don't give a shit what you think, you lose out on at least a good 40, 50% of the experience of living, no? Or...
Good point.
You know, because like other people, you are sharing this planet. When you fart in an elevator and there's other people in it, they will be smelling it too. It's not just you. So
fart is always a good thing to do. But
farting's great.
Going to the essence of your question, I think that I think you're right. It depends on your goal in life. And to me, I do have a goal in life to leave something meaningful behind.
Right.
And I think that the search for meaning is something that has always been a center in my life. It's the center of my business. It's the center of how I view the world. And I think being in service of people is the essence of well-being for people. Do meaningful things creates for you a meaningful life. I think psychology has worked that out for quite some time already. It's greatly based in self-determination theory. And meaningful things lead to a meaningful life based on self-determination theory. That's one of my beliefs. And meaningful things for me is doing things for other people. Mainly is sharing my views, my vision, my knowledge that I think of in the world to create more, I think what's the word? Rechtvaardigheid, it's in Dutch. It's, I think, justice, but I'm not sure if that translates well.
I think that's the word. As you can tell by my thick Dutch accent, I am far from a Dutch dictionary, but I think, you know, Jamie, look it up. Sorry, I just like saying that even though I don't have anyone.
But I think that's a underlying value in who I am. So I think that they balance out. So the voice is strong, but it is authentic and congruent with a love for people.
Yeah, justice.
Yeah.
Righteousness. Righteousness. Fairness, equity. Fairness.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And I think that, well, many people, I think, have experienced a little bit bullying or at least a perception of that in their childhood. And I think that
it was. Oh, yeah. There's a reason why I have a face for radio. I know what that's like.
Exactly. So I think that has created that feeling. And I think that right now, because I've experienced this, that the voice in speaking my truth about these topics is growing.
All right. And so you've done, so this Ritalin experiment you're talking about, is that the only kind of drug or supplement that you've added to your repertoire besides, what was it, ginseng root?
Right now it is.
Okay.
I've cut down on all the other supplements. And okay, after a couple of years was like, okay, it's time to take out the hyper-focus and only focusing on recovering. And then you need to adopt to become more aware of all the parts of your life, sport, family, friends, work. So they go up, and then you are trying to uncover the right balance between all the big elements.
So it's as though those people are your PlayStation vibrator, controller vibration thing. They become your sense checkers.
Exactly.
Reason why I was asking is because I take this shit, lion's mane and stuff and other kinds of little things that I notice improve my focus and enhanced like getting in the zone kind of thing. And I was curious, for someone that has gone through the definition of, well, literally a brain injury and having to get the brain back into shape. Yeah. I was curious if you came across anything that, like, I don't know, people can fuck with and start trying and doing this. Ritalin aside, obviously, but any sort of natural homeopathic supplements that you thought, hey, shit, after my injury, this really helped improve the way I processed language or understood concepts or got into the sort of zone, if you will, or the flow state, you know. Nothing. Far from being Andrew Huberman, you do have his beard, but...
Nothing in particular that has like that.
That click.
That click, not the magic pill that we all aim at.
No, of course.
And there's also the, I really don't know the effects of all the supplements I've took, because there's the Hawthorne effect that states, okay, if you're going to do something, there's a placebo effect by definition. I got better just by doing nothing.
Yes, just the act of doing the experiment influences the experiment's outcome itself.
Is already influencing it. I think what's important is to dance with it and continuously change and adapt what you do, because the moment it gets institutionalized, the effect lowers.
Mm.
The goal is movement, continuously moving. So what I did in over the last 4 years is each year set a couple of goals. It was like, then it's sport, then it's family. And the goal is each year to pick something different to ultimately get the balance of equality over all four: family, friends, sport, work. And each year a different one gets top priority. And the goal is to then equal it out over time.
Right. So what's the goal for this year then?
The goal for this year is sport and family. Because last year was work.
Yeah.
And then all the other things die down. And the goal is this year, those two, and to have at least two in balance. And next year will be to have all four in balance in a sort of state of equilibrium.
Interesting.
And
So why don't you take me through, so you said you have a second life now.
Yeah.
Is this second life different than the previous life? Or is it just like you had a hiccup, you had an oopsie, and now you're just like, now I give less fucks. Like, oops, I dropped all my fucks. No more fucks to give. Sorry, guys. Fucks are gone. What is it then?
Both. Because it's like the experience of reality is different.
Okay, how so?
So, well, you have less fucks to give.
Sure.
You experience reality differently because you have less fucks to give. You've been through the water. I didn't get the epiphany or the leadership, blah, blah, bullshit that you get after that. But it does change perception of reality. When that changes, it changes how you interact with people and what you do. People feel it. And they respond to that in equal. And that's, it's non-tangible.
It's, as in they give less fucks?
No, as in things that you say are perceived differently in their perception of reality.
How do you know what that is?
You don't. But I do experience a difference in the things that I say and the things that I try to achieve. When it comes to, for example, my work is creating self-managing organizations.
Mm.
Create more meaningful work for people. Which is often about how people are perceived, how they do authority, power, how they take responsibility. And that was my work before that, and it's still my work. They respond differently to the things I say, because apparently there's a level of depth that got into how I speak, what I speak, the things that I say, the way I put it, apparently. The perhaps even a little bit more lightheartedness that accompanies with it. I think that's so in that sense is both, because you have your truth, I have mine. And right now we're creating the third one in this interaction between you and me.
Okay. And then so
you and me.
So you're doing the same that you did before, essentially. Well, you're the same job, essentially.
Yeah.
But did more this experience, so in your pursuit for meaning, does that mean that you still find this work meaningful?
Yeah. Well, even more meaningful.
Okay.
Because I've started my own business. I've increased the risk taking to get shit done, to actually go at it with current power structures, in which I am before perhaps was a little more careful.
Can you give an example? Like, what do you mean?
Just play games that could get you fired, because I don't care.
Well, now I'm curious. Go on. What game did you play that could have gotten someone fired or you fired?
Well, I played a couple. I play multiple. But it always has to do with power. And current power structures aim to remain and keep their current power in order. And I don't do authority. Not because I don't want to, or not because I'm per se rebellious, but because I firmly believe that hierarchical power structures are soul crushing.
Hmm.
And people are not children, so we need to give them the space to flourish and give them the acknowledgement that they can make decisions and have their own authority and do what's right for an organization or a group of people.
Right.
And the goal is always to give people on the floor doing the actual work more decision voting power. But there's always a manager on top, or multiple managers that don't like that. And I play games to get them to give power. And they don't like that. They don't like to be called.
Like what? Is there something that people could use? These games you speak of, like, well, what's a game that someone could be like, yeah, fuck, let's fuck with power. I feel like Zach De La Roja a little bit here.
It starts with making decisions and not doing what people tell you to do, but doing what people need you to do. So there was one case. Well, it actually got me fired, which is good. Because that was needed. in which management was like really pushing for it. You micromanaging, do this,
all
do
right.
this. Then it was like, then they did an agile transformation, which was not a real transformation. It was just, okay, we're going to call things differently. And then they were like, we're going to give you autonomy now. And it was like, after 5 minutes, because shit went all right, it was like, no, do this. But I don't do that. I do what's necessary in the long term and not right. focus on burning fires or squashing fires in the short term.
Yeah.
Ensure that people have a space in which they can do the right thing. That's the only thing management needs to do. Create the system that people can do great things, because people want to, can do, and they often need you to simply get out of the way. And I say that to people, that this is what you do. This is what happens. This is how it makes me and other people feel. And what I require you to do is the following. And sometimes that works. Sometimes it doesn't. But you have to have your back straight. And I'm willing to do that to signal also to other people on the floor that self-authority is something to aim for. It liberates.
And what do you think prevents people from doing that?
Bunch of things, systemic issues. Quiet quitting is a thing.
Quiet quitting, what's that? Just like not showing up or not giving a fuck?
Yeah. Show being present in the office physically, but not mentally. And just doing nothing, perhaps doing some open source work in the boss's time, stuff like that. That's happening. People not believing anymore that they have the ability to influence, and their locus of control can be quite low. And if the locus of control is low, people won't take responsibility or action.
That's a good point. Locus of control. I deal with that a little bit in my trainings as well with clients. What does that mean for you, locus of control?
It's your personal perception of the amount of ability you have to influence the world around you.
And so like internal locus of control is...
Yeah, well, it's like a scale. If your locus of control is like close to zero,
yeah,
and you say, okay, I don't have any decision power to create something in the world in this particular environment, in my team or my business or my, can also be in your personal life.
Sure.
And
yeah, definitely.
I often try to get people to see that their locus of control is way higher, because just do. And if you do things, people will see it. And more importantly, people don't even have the guts or the desire to stop you from doing it. So I try to give people that sense of feeling so that they will show to others that they are aiming to get that responsibility. And then step two that you need to do is cut rules, just slash them for a big part. Rules are good to some extent, or at least boundaries are good.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between rules and boundaries.
Exactly.
So, okay, so you've gone through, so you were doing your agile coaching, helping people become self-managed leaders and working in great teams. Then you had your injury. And then afterwards, after retraining yourself to get back into things, went back into it. But now you seem as though you have this like renewed sense of purpose or of identity. What is that? You know, is there something that like, do we need to go through a traumatic event in order to redefine our purpose? Or can we do something that switches us out of routine? That switches us out of rhythm and then helps us realign it. Like, do we need to get hit by that truck, or can we consciously change things ourselves independent of that? What do you think?
you, in order to create,
yeah,
it has to be something that you destroy.
Not easy, Schumpeter.
Deep. The traumatic, it depends.
It depends. Okay. Question, what does it depend on?
The individual or the group?
I guess the individual. I mean, as much as I'd love to have my podcast broadcast to groups of people at a time, I'm pretty sure there's going to be one person listening to this. Or maybe someone else they're torturing them with in the car. Like, hello, Michael's on the radio. Let's listen to this idiot. Yeah.
No, I don't think that you need to have that epiphany. Or I think there's only one organization that can provide that, and that's the NS, the Dutch Spoorwegen, because apparently, opeens heb je het, je wordt conducteur.
You don't know. As in, you're using a train reference.
Yeah. Well, it was
the Nederlandse Spoorwegen, the Dutch railway system.
It was a commercial, and they had like, opeens heb je het, je wordt conducteur. It's like the epiphany. That can happen. But it's not required. It depends. If you take a intrinsic motivational approach, then you need to have that drive.
Right.
However, you can hack your patterns. You can hack your behavior. And then you're taking an external perspective. And I think people are habitual creatures that are defined by the patterns that we have. So if you have like a goal in mind, you don't need to have that deep purpose and epiphany and the whole kumbaya ayahuasca journey effort to get there. Because if you daily work on changing your patterns, then you'll get there. It takes about 30 days to create a small new pattern.
Yeah.
And you can automate that if you, for example, it's fairly easy. If you take your iPhone and you create an automated assignment on that to remind you of the desire to change a specific pattern, then you're already driving yourself from an external perspective in changing your behaviors until it's so ingrained, institutionalized as a pattern in your mind that you act that you'll act naturally and do it. And to give an example, I'm doing the experiment with the Ritalin.
Yeah.
And I'm quite sure that I'll forget taking it because I'm a chaotic person by nature and I go with my own flow and I forget a whole bunch of things.
Sure.
So each morning, I'll get a text from my own phone stating, don't forget, take it. Each Monday, I'll get a text, don't forget, fill in the survey you created for yourself.
Mm.
Stuff like that. And this automation needs to happen for a month or three, and then I'll don't need it anymore because
you have created that habit. All right. I mean, so I take kind of a, I don't disagree. I think that's both of the, that actually works. There's also this other approach, a little bit more philosophically rooted. There's a guy named Soren Kierkegaard. He's a Danish philosopher. And in Kierkegaard's, one of his books called The Concept of Anxiety, he mentioned this concept called anxiety. He says that basically we live on different planes of existence. So we have, and what I would imagine is, imagine this is like my whole world. This post-it note is pretty much everything that it's my whole perspective, my beliefs, my norms, my philosophies. This is my everything, you know? And in order for me to get from like this to this, I need to make what he calls a qualitative leap into another state of perspectives. And the only thing that can drive me to that qualitative leap is that I need to get literally to the end of that, the edge of that bit. And I'm driven to that edge of that perspective or state of thinking or way of thinking through anxiety. And it's anxiety that pushes me to the edge of that concept and forces me to look down in what he calls, so over here is what he calls the dizzying abyss of uncertainty.
Yeah.
You need to come face to face with the fact that, you know, it's like those posters like, well, what if I fall? Well, what if I fly? You know, yep. It's that kind of shit. But in philosophy, his concept of anxiety is that it's anxiety that drives us. And it's even the concept itself of anxiety is the sense of impending doom, the mm-hmm. feeling like this might not be right, that this might not be good, might not be correct. It's like, it's how I would imagine some intolerant people would deal with a shift in cultural changes. So what I'm saying is, I don't disagree that you need mm-hmm. to add routines and rhythms to reprogram your body, but sometimes you need shit to happen in order for you to make shit happen. And in back in your mentioning of locus of control, perhaps the sense of internal versus external locus of control, the sense that external events will change how you perceive you have control over your life and decisions, might actually be more potent than the perception that you have full control over yourself. Because if that's the case, it's more comfortable for someone to be fat and lazy instead of get off your ass in the morning and go to the gym. You know, there's got to be some kind of impending sense of doom or finality. In your case, it was that event, the huge traumatic event. But in other people's cases, it might be, shit, I might lose my partner, or holy crap, my dad just had a heart attack, so maybe I need to eat better, or some kind of external event. So this is what I'm saying is, to what extent can that sense of awareness of the bitter reality that is life, the universe, and everything sometimes have an influence on the routines we then choose?
I think I align with what Kierkegaard says.
Yeah.
And you need to have that, or at least it often happens. But if you say it like that, that anxiety, the question is, how deep does it go? Because it slices you slowly and more and more. And I think it happens within myself. It's a process that there's a great book by Harrison Owen called Spirit that also talks about these transformations. First, you have the out of depth phase. That's like staring into the abyss. It's like the not knowing. And then you go slowly towards vision, and then to language and change. And then you come to accept the new covenant, the new reality that is upon you.
Sure.
I think that the habitual patterns that help you be in that uncertainty, and they can also drive you towards that. At least that's how I employ them. So there's like a sort of conviction to, okay, walk to where it hurts. Go to the place of pain, because there something interesting is there. I think you need that anxiety.
Yeah, I agree.
But the question is it that negative? And that's a bit of the where it becomes interesting is, like, we tend to perceive that anxiety, the not knowing, the abyss. It's even in the words of how Kierkegaard describes it, staring into the abyss. It's almost scary if you tell it to me.
Yeah.
But it's just a black hole. It's nothing more than a black hole, if you call it.
Yeah, but for some, when you're being pushed up against an edge, and that black hole is what everything that it's either back to where comfort and warm safety of whatever your previous perception is, and the next step is, I need to jump over this. into a new qualitative state of being, a new theory of reality, it's literally a complete, it's like in philosophy, in psychology, it's like a gestalt shift. And so, you know, those pictures where you can see like the old woman or the young woman, but you can't see them at the same time. That's gestalt psychology. It's the notion that you can either hold one truth, absolute truth about reality in your mind at a time or something like that. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know where we got, how we got to Kierkegaard. No, but
I know how we got there, because to me, the essence of what you need to realize in this instance is that we got here through, okay, do you need like that big scary trauma to do this type of change? And my my argument was like, no, I don't think so. Just work on those patterns, and then you'll move towards that. And he was like, okay, but if I, then you took the anxiety perspective of Kierkegaard.
That's true.
And I think my important, at least the insight that I feel, is like the sun is coming up tomorrow.
Hope so.
And your house is probably going to be there tomorrow.
Hope so too.
The supermarket will be open tomorrow, probably, or at least
probably
to get food.
That is, we're becoming more and more uncertain as we go.
a bit. But it's like, if you describe it in that extreme anxiety level, it gets heavy, and we judge it, and we get scared, and we feed into the fear. But the not knowing is simply the not knowing. We don't know. And it's okay. There's no judgment to me in that place. And I think that's probably the essence of the work that I often do, is holding the space of being okay that we don't know. We see what happens. And I drive myself with those patterns, and they give like a gist of certainty. Because, okay, at least what I do know is I have locus of control and control over I drink this or not.
Yeah.
I do this or not, which increases that control to be less scared in that staring into the abyss. And I think it's that dance between those two that help you jump to the next plane. And surround yourself with people, elderly people, which can tell these stories of the things that they, because we're not unique. I think we might consider ourselves to be unique, but probably not. It's that listen to the tales and the folks that share the stories of their jumping on a next plane.
That's and really cool.
It happened. Then it will slowly happen. And when you're in, and when it doesn't, then you probably can go off to the jungle, drink ayahuasca, and hope it will happen.
You can turn to drugs.
But
awesome.
Essentially, I don't think it's required. You can get yourself there. And the crux is just be with other people that can share their stories to enrich your own perception of your reality, so you can create your own story and jump to the next plane.
I couldn't have said it better myself, my man. Hey, listen, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. As always, very deep and insightful. And I'm sure that there's lots of lessons here that people can take with them that that might help them, I don't know, change things they want to change. It's the, you know, it's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life for me. I mean, sorry, I'm quoting
you.
Sorry,
I've been jabbering on and on.
That's the whole point. That's the point of this podcast, right? I'm the one asking questions to interesting people and everything. If they wanted to hear me talk, you know, they can book my time. No, no. Again, seriously, I really appreciate the time you took to chat with me today, Kevin.
It was good, and it was fun, and it was good seeing and talking to you again.
Wicked. Well, hey, listen, I'm gonna love you and leave you. But if before we do, is there any way that for those of us listening here in internet lands, that people could reach out to you or they can connect with you? What's the best way they can do that? Or what, where can they learn more about you and the things you do?
Definitely. It's very old school press, but I have a website.
No.
Yeah. And it even has flashy things. Now, it's veranderdgewoon.nl, because my opinion is change is just normal. So the Dutch translation is veranderdgewoon.nl. But you can also find me on LinkedIn or on Twitter. And please do reach out, because I love to share stories and the things I've learned on change and self-management. And, well, actually, these kind of things, to share that with the world, because I think because it helped me. So I would love to
Right.
others with the things that have helped me.
Brilliant. Either way, I'll put some of those links up in the description and stuff. But again, Kev, really appreciate your time, man. And I'll see you real soon.
See you real soon. Peace.
Peace.